on the Lee Amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. Thank you, Ms. Lee.
Hey.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
The one piece of good news all day.
I've got the feeling that something ain't right.
Well,
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Maybe we'll have some more.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
But I doubt it.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. and Radio Sputnik, amongst others, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. Glad to have you with us. Coming up, the GOP scheme to repeal and replace Obamacare, that is not dead yet. No, it is not. Even though senators have now recessed for the 4th of July Independence Day break. In fact, at least one senator has proposed a new idea that I got to tell you, I find very troubling on a number of levels. And that scheme has now been endorsed by Donald Trump. More on that and what you can and or should do over the July 4th recess to make your voices heard by your senators. We'll be joined momentarily by the Progressive Change Campaign Committee's Kate Sweeney to discuss that. A little bit later, Desi Doyen will be joining us with the latest Green News report.
Yay.
Hello, Desi Doyen.
Hello.
It's our last one for a week or so, as we too will be taking a holiday recess next week. But never fear, Angie Coiro of In Deep Radio will be filling in for us for most of those days next week. Don't forget to tune in for that. As we noted in our most recent program, the climate crisis that we tried to cover in detail, marking the 29th anniversary of NASA chief scientist James Hansen's warning to the U.S. Senate all the way back in 1988 about the dangers of global warming. And the fact that it is what he was warning about in 1988 is exactly what we are now seeing today. That crisis continues, of course. And got another landmark, Desi Doyen. I don't know if you saw this. You may not be happy about it. In Iran, did you see this story?
No,
yet?
I didn't.
A city in southwest Iran posted the country's hottest temperature ever recorded Thursday afternoon and may have tied the world record for the most extreme high temperature.
Oh, wow.
Ever recorded. French meteorological agency posted to Twitter that the city of Avaz soared to 53.7 degrees Celsius, that is 128.7 degrees Fahrenheit. A new absolute national record of reliable Iranian heat, they said, and the hottest temperature ever recorded in June over mainland Asia. But Weather Underground's website indicates that the temperature in Avaz climbed even higher, hitting 129.
Oh my gosh.
0.2.
Wow.
If that's accurate, it would arguably tie the hottest temperature ever measured on Earth.
Ever reliably measured on Earth.
That's
right. There is a record that was set in Death Valley in 1934. I believe it was 134.
1913.
1913,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that, however, is not necessarily verified. So as a verified temperature in Iran, this is important.
It is. The excessive hot air over Avaz, which is a city of 1.1 million people. This is not out in the middle of nowhere. Apparently, it felt even worse because of high humidity. As the temperature climbed into the 120s, the dew point, which is the measure of humidity, peaked in the low 70s, which is a high for this desert. It's a desert location.
Yeah,
and
that's
they had
weird.
So the heat index, which measures how hot it feels when you factor in humidity, exceeded 140 degrees.
That gets to be in lethal territory.
Beyond levels that heat index was even designed to compute. So they don't even know for sure. And that was the second straight day of record heat in Avaaz. They hit 127.2 degrees the day before. This comes just a month after several locations in the Middle East had recorded their hottest temperatures during another heat wave that you had reported on in Pakistan, 128 degrees there. All of these record-breaking temperatures, of course, are exactly what scientists have been warning about so many years.
Yeah, I mean, that is how the system works. When you pump all of the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it creates a blanket. It traps the heat radiating off the Earth from the sun. Things get hotter. It changes weather patterns so that you have these heat waves that park over areas and just kind of get stuck there. So you get these extended heat waves, and it's the extended heat waves that are so deadly because human beings don't have time to cool down.
Yeah, a study in the Nature Climate Change Journal in 2015 cautioned that by the end of the century, because of climate change, temperatures in the Middle East may become too hot for human survival.
Yeah.
So here's some good news, however. The House of Representatives Appropriations Committee passed, a powerful Appropriations Committee passed an amendment repealing the authorization for the use of military force that was passed just days after the September 11, 2001 attacks. And it has been used, this AUMF has been used to justify military action abroad ever since. By George W. Bush, by Barack Obama, now Donald Trump, who is also using it somehow, though it applies to supposedly Al-Qaeda and their affiliate groups. He's also using it to justify his attacks against the Syrian government. And frankly, Democrats are allowing him to do so. They're not complaining at all. It's kind of insane. In any event, this one authorization fits all measure that was passed literally, I think, 2 or 3 days right after the September 11 attack was opposed only at the time. The only person in Congress to oppose it in either the House or the Senate was California Congresswoman Barbara Lee. And she has been year after year trying to pass an amendment to do away with this broad authorization for the use of military force that is being used, as she predicted way back in 2001, being used by presidents to pretty much do anything they want militarily anywhere in the world. So this amendment was passed as part of the fiscal year 2018 defense spending bill, which the committee approved on Thursday. It was adopted on a voice vote, after which there was a lot of people in the room went, wow, according to a Politico reporter, Jennifer Schultes, a room full of wows, she said. And now this has only been approved by the committee. It can still be stripped out before the this particular budget amendment is voted on the floor. But potentially, this is very good news because both Republicans and Democrats alike had voted to kill this stupid, deadly authorization that has been used to deploy U.S. forces to Afghanistan, the Philippines, Georgia, Yemen, Djibouti, Kenya, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Iraq, and Somalia, and, of course, Syria. Here was Barbara Lee, on Rachel Maddow last night, talking about the successful passage of her resolution.
Congress must stop being missing in action on matters of war and peace. Upon the signing of this legislation, it would stay in effect for 8 months. That would give us time to debate the pros and cons of a new authorization to use force, bring forth however many there would be, debate the issues, and then vote up or down on a new authorization. And so believe you me, Congress can and should pass a new resolution within 8 months because the American people deserve this. It's our job. We have been missing in action, and I'm so pleased that we had bipartisan support to do this.
Good for her. Good for Barbara Lee. There is some good news for today. That may be it. Because it appears that after the Senate Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's so-called Better Care Reconciliation Act to repeal and replace Obamacare flopped in the Senate after he failed to get the bare majority 50 votes needed for passage from his own caucus, his subsequent effort to buy off wavering Republicans with the $200 billion that the Congressional Budget Office says the bill would make available to him and still meet rules to pass this thing with a bare 50 minimum votes, that effort has failed as well. That would seem to be good news. He had hoped for an amended version of the bill that could pass muster to receive 50 Republican votes before leaving for the 4th of July recess, but instead the Senate gave up and went home. They will reconvene, however, on the matter in early July. And in the meantime, that means senators are now back in their home states and facing constituents who may have a few opinions on the wildly unpopular GOP measure that has already been passed in the House to kill the Affordable Care Act. By largely gutting its Medicaid expansion program to some 11 million Americans in exchange for some $800 billion in tax cuts for wealthy Americans. Progressive grassroots groups have been organizing to target GOP senators back in their home states over the holiday recess with their opinions, particularly those senators that they feel are vulnerable in the 2018 election or who have been wavering in their support of the Republican effort. One such group is the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, the PCC, announced on Friday that they are ramping up pressure on vulnerable Republicans, some of whom are facing re-election bids this year, in hopes of getting their opposition and firming up their opposition in any event to the Senate Republican health care bill. Those groups, particularly the PCC specifically, has been running an emotionally compelling ad in West Virginia in recent days, targeting a vote against the Senate effort by West Virginia's Senator Shelley Moore Capito. Today, the group announced they are extending that ad buy into states like Texas and Arizona and Nevada, targeting Republican senators like Ted Cruz, Jeff Flake, and Dean Heller, all seen as vulnerable. The West Virginia ad features two women who rely on Medicaid to survive.
This is Micah, my beautiful, loving daughter. Because of her cerebral palsy, she's needed constant care for the last 38 years. When I hear that Senator Shelley Moore Capito may vote with President Trump to cut her Medicaid, I want to cry. I can't afford Micah's care if this bill passes. Without it, my daughter could die from seizures. Look at her face. Tell me, Senator Capito, what am I supposed to do?
That ad from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, PCCC founder, co-founder Adam Green says the group is now doubling down on pressuring vulnerable 2018 Republicans by daring them to look into the faces of real people who could die if Medicaid is cut, women in the ad like Micah Spence, in order to pay for massive tax cuts to the rich. But on Friday, as the Senate struggles to come up with a bill to repeal and replace Obamacare that could possibly win approval of 50 Republican senators, one Republican suggested repealing the Affordable Care Act now and devising a replacement later. According to TPM, President Donald Trump quickly jumped on board. Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, wrote a letter to Trump on Friday morning suggesting a plan to repeal Obamacare now with a year-long delay in implementation, setting up Congress to work on a replacement plan this summer. Sasse asked Trump to call on Republicans to repeal Obamacare in early July if they can't reach an agreement on a comprehensive plan. He suggested Congress then cancel its August recess to work on a replacement plan and pass that by Labor Day. Trump quickly praised the plan. Senate leaders pitched this approach in January, but that plan was shelved when at least four senators opposed the strategy. But now Senator Rand Paul, one of those who had initially opposed the strategy in January, threw his support behind this approach on Friday morning. And I would say there is reason to be very concerned about this strategy. For one, if Republicans repealed the Affordable Care Act now with a one-year deadline before it actually ends, that begins a ticking clock the Democrats would have a very tough time ignoring, given that health care for more than 20 million Americans would simply go away at the end of that year. Yes, they would be able to blame Republicans for it if it happened, but the fact would be that once a full repeal of Obamacare is a done deal, many Democrats would justifiably, I think, find themselves in a position where they would feel they are forced to work with Republicans somehow to come up with something, anything to put in its place to minimize the damage somehow. I think that's a, or would be, could be, a very dangerous and troubling position for Democrats to be in. Joining us now to discuss that potential predicament and, in the shorter term, what Americans can and should and will do over the holiday recess while senators are in their home states is Kate Sweeney. She's the press secretary for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, the ones who produce that ad targeting Republican senators in vulnerable states. The PCCC is a grassroots organization with over 1 million members nationwide supporting bold progressive candidates and organizations for progressive priorities. Kate Sweeney, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me.
Kate, I had originally hoped to have you on to discuss your group's plans and recommendations for voters over the 4th of July recess to reach senators. But now I need to ask you about this new initiative. It's not getting a lot of attention yet, but I think it could be very potent and put Dems in a very difficult position. Do you share those concerns? I know it's early, but what can progressives do to counter such an initiative?
Well, I think this is a strategy born from desperation. I mean, whether it's strict repeal or repeal and replace, millions are going to lose their health care, and it's a non-starter with voters. I don't see how a moderate like Capito or Heller can justify to their constituents a vote that would cut taxes on the wealthy or remove all protection for pre-existing conditions and essential health benefits and get rid of the Medicaid expansion. And there would be no softening effect. All the pain of the repeal would be felt immediately. And I think voters are smarter than Republicans give them credit for. I mean, they know the Republican plan is clearly worse than Obamacare. They know that the divisions within the Republican caucus aren't going to magically go away when they're facing another arbitrary deadline of their own making a year down the road, and right before an election. Mm-hmm. So I think senators are going to face a steep political price for gambling with the health care of millions of Americans, and I don't see how moderates sign on to that. That being said, we're not going to just assume that it's not going to be successful. We see this as a critical moment to hold Republican senators' feet to the fire. I mean, McConnell is using this delay to get those squishy senators to vote yes for Medicaid cuts to sign on to his bill, and we can't allow a bait and switch. So what we're saying to the grassroots is let's use every tool at our disposal, protest, phone calls, TV ads, to make sure that Republican senators see the pain and worry that their constituents have over this bill.
And I know that you guys were back during, and I want to talk about some specific advice you might have for folks over the holiday recess, but back during the battle to pass the Affordable Care Act, I know that the PCC C, three C's, was on the front lines. There you go,
PCCC.
Thank you, yes.
It rolls off the tongue a little bit better.
Yeah, it does. I know that you guys were on the front lines back then calling for a public health insurance option to be instituted with Obamacare. And now you've partnered with Senate Democrats on a resolution calling for a public health option. Let's start here. What is the status of that measure, and what would it possibly take for it to even receive the light of day on the floor of the U.S. Senate right now?
Well, I think what's really interesting is the difference between 2009 and today is that back then the public option was really treated as the ceiling to the healthcare debate. Mm-hmm. Then anything beyond that was just considered impossible. And now it's really the floor. You really have to see the entire Democratic caucus, both in the House and the Senate, rallying around the idea of any kind of bipartisan solution to health care would have to at least, in the minimum, include a public option or some kind of Medicare buy-in for all. And that, you know, single payer is still the goal, and that's part of the debate. But definitely the public option is the floor.
And this was something that actually came up that I was trying to make some noise with when Obamacare was initially being passed in 2009-2010. If you guys are trying to push for what America needs, why not push only for a single-payer Medicare for All-style system and then compromise, if necessary, later on with the public option if needed? You know, the fact that there was an effort for a public option meant that the compromise was what we ended up with, Obamacare. Why not only push
right.
for a single-payer system?
I think Bernie Sanders had it best on Chris Hayes yesterday, which is that we're not abandoning the single-payer system. That's still the goal. We're being realistic about what can be, you know, achieved in this particular political moment. What we're saying as a party is that, you know, we will not accept any changes to Obamacare that weaken protections for Americans, that cut care, that raise premiums. Like, we'll work to build upon Obamacare mm-hmm. with a public option that would inject much needed competition into the system. But we're not going to go backwards. And then we would, of course, always like to work towards a single-payer system, and that is the ultimate.
The PCCC has a petition out now describing a health care meeting between Democrats and Republicans could be an opportunity for progressives to expand the debate to forward-looking reforms that we care about. But it could be a disaster if Democrats aren't ready to fight or if it closes off debate about single-payer. Well, are Democrats ready to fight at this point? I know there is a single payer a bill that's in the House, and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have supported single payer. Do you have any confidence? But the leadership, the Democratic leadership, has really backed off that. Do you have any confidence that Democrats are ready to fight?
Well, I mean, there's definitely some good signals. The Senate Democrats have had a very visible, robust defense that is both supported and encouraged the grassroots and real people participation. It's given life to the calls and online attention that we've seen. You know, we have turned up that pressure and ensure that all the future conversations on healthcare focus both on truly improving the ACA with public option, but also have single payer in that mix. And that was why it was great to see Elizabeth Warren really talking about the need for single payer. And I think you're seeing that with the public support that is growing around in voters mm-hmm. for single payer. And there's just a greater understanding that the healthcare system needs competition from the government and needs competition that is not a plan that is not solely profit focused to help lower costs and to provide care for people. So if you're seeing the support grow over time, you know, I think I see encouraging signals from leadership. We'll have to see going forward. And that certainly PCCC will continue to pressure for a single payer.
That petition, by the way, and we'll try to link to it from bradblog.com, says that any healthcare deal between Democrats and Republicans must, at a minimum, include a very strong public option or a Medicare buy-in for all, bring prescription drug prices down, and give fair consideration to single-payer health care. That would be nice. We'll try to link to that. Kate Sweeney, what is the PCCC planning, organizing over the holiday recess? You and other grassroots groups I know you're working with, what are your recommendations, I guess, to your members that they do over the week when Congress is in recess for the 4th of July holiday break?
Sure. Well, today we just announced that we're actually going to be expanding that ad into Nevada, Texas, and Arizona. We'll mm-hmm. be targeting Senators Heller, Flake, and Cruz, telling them to you know, look into the face of Micah Spence and explain how they're going to cut Medicaid and thus put her life at risk. What I would say to the grassroots is get involved. I mean, now is the time to call your Senate offices, in district offices, to attend events that you know that they're going to be at, to tweet at them, to sign petitions. If you have concern about the direction that this country is going under Trump and McConnell and Republicans, now is the time to have your voices be heard.
Make your voices heard. Call your senator, particularly in their district offices. Hey, they're home. They're back in town all week. Go see them.
Yeah. And it's working. Yeah. I mean, Heller was next. You know, he's cited the concerns of his constituents. It's one of the reasons that he has come out as a bill on draft, and we're pushing him now to unequivocally say that he's opposed to any Medicaid cuts. So these phone calls matter. These tweets matter. Mm-hmm. They have an impact, a real impact. So I encourage everybody to get involved. Now is the time to fight.
That's Dean Heller, of course, Senator in Nevada, Republican, who is up for re-election, thought to be the most vulnerable in the country as far as Republicans in states that that I believe Hillary Clinton won. Kate Sweeney is the press secretary for the PCCC, otherwise known as the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. You can get more information on them, their work, their ads that they are running now around the country at boldprogressives.org and on the Twitters at boldprogressive. Kate Sweeney, good luck over the next week or so. I think we're all going to need it. And thanks for joining us today.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Okay, some election integrity news and really some disturbing voter suppression news coming up. Donald Trump's so-called Election Integrity Commission gets to work and already shoots itself in the foot in their first embarrassing, if troubling, effort. That story and much more out of our twisted presidential administration right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to The Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yes, we are on the watchtower. We are always on the watchtower here. But you know, anybody who listens to closely and regularly to this show probably knows at least one of the reasons that I remain dubious, skeptical, dubious about the so-called claims about Russian attacks on our election. One of the reasons is because if Democrats under the Barack Obama administration were so certain about Russian attempts to try and steal the election for Donald Trump, the easiest way for Russia to really have done that would be to have manipulated our wildly vulnerable and easy to hack computerized voting machines and tabulators that are used in all 50 states, and they're all unbelievably vulnerable. But the Obama administration refused to do so before or after the election, and for some reason refused to ask for a hand count to make sure that the results as reported were actually correct. And given all their claims about, you know, our election being hacked or attempting that, why wouldn't they ask for a hand count of the ballots just to make sure the computers were reporting them correctly, or at least, you know, help Green Party candidate Jill Stein in her attempt to do so in three different states. She tried in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, all of which blocked the attempted hand counts and forensic investigations of voting systems during the post-election canvass prior to certification of the Electoral College in December. So if they really believe that Russia was determined to game our election, I don't understand. Frankly, there is no excuse from finding out if they or anyone else did so by examining the actual evidence of the reported vote count and the machines, not humans, but programmable and hackable computers that reported those results. Yet another story out today confirms that they did no such thing and for some reason still do not want to. This is from Sam Thielman at TPM. Pressure to examine voting machines used in the 2016 election grows daily as evidence builds that Russian hacking attacks were broader and deeper than previously known, and the Department of Homeland Security has a simple response. No. DHS officials from former Secretary Jay Johnson under Obama to acting director of Cyber Division Samuel Lyles may be adamant that machines were not affected, but the agency has not in fact opened up a single voting machine since November to check. This just out today. How long have we been yelling and screaming about that, Des?
Yeah, I know.
Since the, since election night,
and
frankly.
And they have continually said that there has been no change in the vote tallies. However, they never
looked.
They
don't know. Exactly. They don't know. It's what I was trying to say from day one. According to the most recent unverified reports, 39 states were targeted by Russian hackers, and DHS has cited, without providing details, domestic attacks in its own reports as well. Thank you. Yes, it's vulnerable not just to Russians, but to domestic attacks, to attacks from China, Iran, England, France, Germany, take your pick, Ohio, Oklahoma. Computer scientists have been critical of the decision to not examine voting systems. Alex Halderman, who testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee last week about the vulnerability of election systems, says they have performed computer forensics on no election equipment whatsoever. That would be one of the most direct ways of establishing if the equipment, whether it's been penetrated by attackers. We have not taken every step we could, he said. David Dill, a voting systems expert and professor of computer science at Stanford University, said, I don't know why they wouldn't try to hack voting machines, and I don't know what would stop them, he told TPM. Any statement that says we haven't seen evidence of X also means we haven't lifted a finger to investigate. While forensic investigations would answer many questions vital to researchers trying to improve voting systems, the potential for eroded confidence in those systems may help to explain DHS's reluctance to seek out hard evidence. In other words, if they bother to look and they find out there was a hack, that would somehow erode confidence in the election systems that we use. So we would rather not know about any problems that exist. We would rather not know if anyone stole an election than take the chance of eroding confidence in our election system amongst the electorate. It makes no sense. Security by obscurity. It makes no sense keeping this stuff secret. This needs to be a public process. If there was a problem, we need to know about it. And if there was not a problem, we need to know about that as well. So we don't have jerks like me asking questions and pointing out the fact that nobody actually knows if the results reported in November of 2016 or just a couple of weeks ago in Georgia, for that matter, if those were reported correctly. It's an insane system. And no matter how long you want to keep it secret, keep it private, not tell people, not look to find out, it ain't going to help. Confidence in our election system continues to erode because of that. Not because of me. Not because of me pointing these things out. Not because of computer scientists like Alex Halderman and David Dill, who have been, you know, hacking into these systems for years and proving just how unbelievably vulnerable they are. And TPM is finally noting, evidence always seems to stop with, quote, we don't know. Yes, thank you. I'm glad that they're finally recognizing that, because frankly, TPM has not been very good on this issue for many, many years. So now they note, today, the dangers are real. Some voting machines still use Windows XP, which Microsoft has not updated in years. It no longer supports it. Cybersecurity expert Jeremy Epstein has personally demonstrated huge security flaws in other machines. For example, in 2015, we covered this at the time on the show, he successfully campaigned to decertify the AVS WinVote machine in Virginia, which is a touchscreen system that used woefully out-of-date and insecure wireless protocols, which can be hacked in about 3 minutes. Epstein, in fact, pulled off that hack successfully, was able to retrieve the WinVote's factory-set passwords. They were coded into the system. Those passwords were very difficult to determine, by the way. They were ABCDE.
Oh, goodness.
And admin. Halderman, too, of course, has dramatically demonstrated how easy it is to take over these voting machines in one case. And this was the case of the Diebold machine that I obtained from a source. We got to Princeton University. In that case, by simply loading a voting machine with a memory card filled with malicious software that could then hitch a ride on that machine back to the central location where the votes are tallied. And by the way, it's easy to do this because machines are left unguarded. They're often sitting there at the polling locations. They're sent home the night before or several days before with poll workers, in which case poll workers can do anything they want with these machines. But for God's sakes, let's not check them afterwards to make sure that didn't happen. So these computer scientists, TPM notes, agree the problem is urgent and, yes, nonpartisan. This is not a partisan issue. I yell and scream about this when Republicans are screwed by our electoral system as much as I do when it's Democrats. So that's what we should be worrying about. Instead, oh, here's what we're worrying about. Remember Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, one of the nation's top GOP voter fraud fraudsters, who ran almost entirely when he ran for Secretary of State on the promise to stop voter fraud in Kansas back in 2010. Well, apparently it was stopped before he even became Secretary of State, because although he's been granted the power to prosecute voter fraud criminals in Kansas, he's the only Secretary of State in the nation with that power. Most have to refer their concerns about fraud to a state or county prosecutor, but Kobach can go after these people directly. He says voter fraud is an epidemic. Well, he's been able to get just 9 convictions since he's been in office out of millions of votes that have been cast in the state of Kansas. Most of those convictions were of elderly people who voted twice because they have a house in a different state. They didn't realize they weren't allowed to. There was one. I think he got one conviction for someone who was a non-citizen voting, despite the fact that he and Donald Trump have said millions of non-citizens are voting in our elections. In any case, along the way, Kobach has instituted some of the most draconian, if not the most draconian, voting restrictions in the nation. Of course, photo ID restrictions. He's also put in place proof of citizenship requirements to even register to vote at all. And after holding tens of thousands of voters in suspense, people trying to register, holding them in suspense for failing to submit those citizenship papers, which many people do not have access to, he was finally ordered to add thousands of voters to the rolls that he had been keeping off of them in one election after another. And in fact, he has been sued time and time again, and he keeps losing time and time again in court, even at the GOP-friendly U.S. Supreme Court. As we told you a few days ago, just about 1 week ago, Kobach was sanctioned and fined by a federal court last Friday for his deceptive conduct in a voting rights case that was brought against him by the ACLU. He'll have to pay a $1,000 fine as punishment for, quote, patently misleading representations during the litigation over that proof of citizenship voter registration requirement that Kobach had put in place or is trying still to implement in his state. Well, now, on Wednesday, all 50 states were sent letters from Chris Kobach, the vice chair for the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity that Donald Trump put together. It's being headed up in nominally by Vice President Mike Pence, but it's Chris Kobach himself who is actually doing this. He's the man. He's the guy. And in fact, he was the one who signed all of these letters out to all 50 states requesting information on voter fraud, election security, and copies of every state's voter roll data. The letter asked state officials to deliver the data within 2 weeks and says that all information turned over to the commission will be made public. And they don't explain what they're going to do with this. So from the actual letter, Kobach writes to all 50 states, in order for the commission to fully analyze vulnerabilities and issues related to voter registration and voting, I am requesting that you provide the commission The publicly available voter roll data for Connecticut, this was the one sent to Connecticut, including if publicly available under the laws of your state, the full first and last names of all registrants, middle names or initials if available, addresses, dates of birth, political party if recorded in your state, last four digits of Social Security number if available, voter history from 2006 onward, active, inactive status, canceled status, information regarding any felony convictions, information regarding voter registration in another state, information regarding military status, and overseas citizen information. And then later in the letter, he adds, please be aware that any documents that are submitted to the full commission will also be made available to the public. So now some of this information is available to the public. Some of it is public information. The laws are different in all of the states. But all of this information is not public in any of the states, to my knowledge. Social Security numbers? Birth date? Military status?
Voting history.
Voting history? Well, some of that is publicly available.
But
you
having
have to,
it all together.
Yeah, you have to ask for it on a case-by-case state. In some states, you have to pay for that information. Or you have to ask for a specific person or a group of information, a single county or something. He's asking for everything, top to bottom, going back to 2006 for use in this so-called Election Integrity Commission that Donald Trump set up because someone told him that millions of non-citizens were casting votes and he believed them and he couldn't take the idea that he lost the popular vote. And so he set up this pretend sham of a commission to investigate it and put Kris Kobach in charge. Kris Kobach, who shoots himself in the foot time and time again on these issues. And now, basically, he's trying to get all of this information so they can misinterpret it in some fashion or another so that they can then say, oh, we've got problems. We've got to stop the National Voter Registration Act, which allows people to register to vote at their, the county, the DMV. And, you know, when people go in to do various government business, they are supposed to be asked if they would like to register to vote. Well, too many people are using that to register to vote. Can't have that. So that's what this commission is all about. And the responses back from the secretaries of state and so forth around the country are kind of amazing. Connecticut Secretary of State Denise Merrill, who is a Democrat, said that her office plans to share publicly available information with the Kobach Commission, but that she will ensure the privacy of voters is honored by withholding protected data. This lack of openness, she says, as far as what they will do with that information, is all the more concerning considering the fact that the vice chair of the commission, Kris Kobach, has a lengthy record of illegally disenfranchising eligible voters in Kansas. The secretary of state out here in California, Kris Kobach, offered similar thoughts. He said the commission was established through executive order by President Donald Trump after he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton. Trump has falsely alleged that 3 to 5 million votes were cast illegally in the 2016 election. This despite the fact that his claims of voter fraud are unsubstantiated and that academics and bipartisan leaders have confirmed that there is no evidence of large scale, let alone massive voter fraud. He said that he would not supply this information to Kris Kobach either. Allison Lundgren Grimes, the Kentucky Secretary of State, said this request from the president's sham commission should alarm every American. I will not release sensitive data about 3.2 million Kentuckians to the federal government. Virginia Governor McAuliffe, Terry McAuliffe, said that he won't send the data to Pence and Kobach and their fake commission. He said, I have no intention of honoring this request. This entire commission is based on the specious and false notion that there was widespread voter fraud last November. At best, he says, this commission was set up as a pretext to validate Donald Trump's alternative election facts, and at worst is a tool to commit large-scale voter suppression. But it is not just Democrats. You might think, oh, well, of course, they're Democrats. That's because they're hiding all of their voter fraud. Not just Democrats here. ProPublica reports that Alabama's Republican Secretary of State, John Merrill, also indicated that he had questions for Kobach regarding how much of the data would be made public and how Alabamans' privacy would be protected, even while he expressed support for the commission. He said, Kobach is a close friend, and I have full confidence in him and his ability, but before we turn over data of this magnitude to anybody, we're going to make sure our questions are answered, he said. So he's a Republican. Now, Ohio Republican Secretary of State John Husted has also turned down the Trump Election Commission's request for voter data, like Social Security and driver's license numbers. He tells them other data is already in the public domain, so they can go and fetch that themselves. But he's not sending Social Security and driver's license numbers to him. And then Rick Hassan, election law professor from UC Irvine, tweeted this afternoon, holy cow, what a blunder. Chris Kobach himself, remember, he's the Secretary of State of Kansas. Chris Kobach can't provide the information he himself requested in the letter. Rick Hassan adds, oh my, oh my. Kobach now says that Kansas won't be sharing the last four digits of the Social Security number, according to KansasCity.com. So even Chris Kobach is turning down Chris Kobach's request. Wow. What a clown we have heading this this bogus voter fraud panel. And as if that clown isn't bad enough, they've now added another clown, Hans von Spakovsky.
Oh, no.
Yes,
really?
Yes. He has now been added. He is sort of the father, the godfather of fake GOP voter fraud the scams. He's been pushing for photo ID voter restrictions for years, has pretended that there is massive voter fraud going on. I don't have time to get into the details of who von Spakovsky is, but even Norm Ornstein, the scholar at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, said, with Hans von Spakovsky on board, Trump's Voter Suppression Commission is like the all-star team of vile, jackboot, partisan voter suppressors.
Meow.
And that's coming from the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. One of these days, I'm going to have to pull out my conversation, my debate with von Spakovsky from years ago. Remember I was on the Tavis Smiley show with von Spakovsky? Yeah, one day maybe. Now, normally, I'd prefer to just ignore stories like this from clowns like Kobach and von Spakovsky. But we can't. That's the problem. They now have the power of the presidency, for Christ's sake, and the federal government behind them, like it or not. So, unfortunately, we can't ignore stories like this. Same thing with this, and we don't have time for it, but this madness, this insanity of Donald Trump going after Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough
on, yes,
MSNBC. We don't have time to cover this, but
it's very dangerous what he is doing.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they came out and said that the White House, that Trump has basically was trying to blackmail them. The White House was, that they needed to apologize for their coverage of the president, and in which case he would stop publication of some bad story in the National Enquirer about them. The White House claims that didn't happen. Scarborough says, yes, it did. I've got the phone records to prove it. We don't know who is telling the truth there, but what we do know is Trump came out with this horrible, ugly, sad, small, disgusting little tweet against Mika Brzezinski. So we know what Trump is willing to do. And if he's willing to do that to high-profile hosts on MSNBC, imagine what he's willing to do to, you know, folks like you and me, Desi Doyen, if, you know, he decides he doesn't like what we're covering. This is a very dangerous time. A story like that, I'd love to ignore. I can't. A story like what Chris Kobach is doing, I'd love to ignore. I can't. This is a very serious and dangerous moment in this country's history. Make no mistake about it. I got to get to a break. We got to come back with the Green News Report. Amazing. All right, I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. There is no stopping the world.
Definitely not.
There is no melting for you. Well, there's a lot of melting going on around the world these days. But we have to get right to it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
I think it's going to be a landmark breakthrough in coal technology, really around the world. First of its kind.
Or not. Experimental clean coal plant switches to natural gas.
The administration is tearing down the legacies of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act.
Trump's EPA moves to undo landmark clean water rule. World's first floating wind farm takes shape off the coast of Scotland. Plus,
they haven't seen this in 28 years because we haven't done stupid stuff like this.
Utah lawmaker blames environmentalists for massive forest fire.
All of that inappropriate blame and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We turn the Forest Service over to the bird and bunny lovers and the tree huggers and the rock lickers. We turned our history over.
Rock lickers? You're not crazy at all, Utah State Rep Mike Noel. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you've got some big news on clean coal. This is our key to the future.
Yeah, except not so much. It's been a major setback for proponents of so-called clean coal. The nation's first commercial clean coal plant, the Kemper plant in eastern Mississippi.
I hear about it. It's great.
It was supposed to convert coal to a gas to generate electricity and then capture its carbon pollution. But on Wednesday, Mississippi Power Company announced it will shift the plant to burn natural gas instead. Mississippi utility regulators are cutting them off because the costly experiment was too risky to customers after years of delays, budget overruns, rate hikes, and more than $1 billion in funding from U.S. taxpayers.
So this is it? This is our clean coal technology, the future of coal that we've been promised for so long?
That's right.
And now it's shut down and they're just using natural gas instead.
Yeah.
So fitting.
The Trump administration this week officially kicked off the process of repealing President Obama's Clean Water Rule, a landmark regulation that clarified EPA authority to allow it to regulate how much pollution could be dumped in wetlands and tributaries that feed into the drinking water supply of one-third of Americans. The Waters of the United States rule has been on hold due to litigation from a coalition of fossil fuel industry groups, manufacturers, agriculture industry groups, and developers who argue the rule violates their property rights. EPA will now withdraw and rewrite the rule.
Well, who needs clean water anyway?
And it's not the first rule that the Trump EPA has withdrawn or postponed. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt has stalled safety regulations for hazardous chemicals established in response to that deadly fertilizer explosion in West Texas. Mm. He's pulled back regulations curbing methane emissions from oil and gas drilling that cause air pollution and contribute to global warming. He's also withdrawn more pesticides rules that were intended to limit exposure impacts to children and farm workers.
Somebody ought to hold an election.
And the Associated Press reports this week that EPA's Pruitt met with the CEO of Dow Chemical, the maker of the widely used pesticide chlorpyrifos, just days before Pruitt decided to withdraw a ban on that pesticide.
Total coincidence.
EPA's own scientists said the pesticide damages the brains of children, even in tiny amounts. The pesticide isn't up for a reassessment again until 2022. In Utah, a state lawmaker blamed conservationists for a wildfire that has burned more than 77 square miles near the Bryan Head Ski Resort in the Dixie National Forest in southern Utah. Utah Republican State Representative Mike Noel used the fire as an opportunity to call for more commercial logging in national forests.
We turned the Forest Service over to the bird and bunny lovers and the tree huggers and the rock lickers. We turned our history over. And the fire is going to do more damage because we're going to lose our watershed, We're going to lose our soils. We're going to lose our wildlife. And we're going to lose our scenery. The very thing you people wanted to try to protect. It's just plain stupidity.
Yeah, you people and your stupidity. So does he have a point? Do we have all of this dead wood up there that should have been logged by the logging companies?
Well, forest ecologists say that while a century of forest fire suppression policy has indeed contributed to the increase in large forest fires, they also say that increased logging of those trees killed by the bark beetle epidemic would not have made a difference in this fire. Finally, some good news. A new frontier opened up in wind energy this week. Norway's state-owned oil and gas company launched the world's first floating wind farm off the coast of Scotland. Set to be fully operational next year, the Hywind project uses pioneering technology to anchor the turbines to the seabed and keep them upright, and could vastly expand the number of suitable areas that can be tapped for offshore wind farms. And also notable because it's an oil company behind the project.
Clean coal plants going to natural gas, oil companies moving to wind, dogs and cats living together. What kind of madness is this? Well, we'll find out in our next thrilling episode. Until then, we'll be off for a week over the holiday. I hope that you and yours have a safe and happy one. Don't forget, you can get more on all of our stories at greennews.bradblog.com. And you can find, follow, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Yep. Indeed.
And so it is with that that we too must hit the dusty trail for a few days. We will be off for the next few days. Angie Coiro of In Deep Radio will be in for us for much of the week over the 4th of July. I hope that you have a safe and pleasant holiday. I hope that I get in a nap. We will see you soon. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Kate Sweeney of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee at boldprogressives.org, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Please consider stopping by bradblog.com/donate. To help us continue to do what we try to do every day over your public airwaves and to put some gas into our gas tank. We'll take it. You can drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. That is it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.